And now we are calling Johnny here. I could turn on a speakerphone like this if I wanted to.
Hello, Steve.
Hey, Johnny, how you doing?
I'm good. How you doing?
Well, it's been 2.5 years, and I can't tell you how thrilled I am to make the first public phone call with iPhone.
Podcast, the best 30-plus minute album conversation you're going to hear all week long. I'm your host, Erfan Elijah. Joining me today, the genius behind Apple's greatest biographical in nature books, Leander Caney.
I didn't quite catch what you said. What was it?
You're the genius behind Apple's greatest biographical in nature books.
Okay.
It's accurate, yeah.
Well, yeah, biographical in nature.
Yeah.
You just said biographical.
Biographical books. Well, are they all biographical?
No.
Okay, we'll see. I didn't want to give you a title that wasn't true.
Right. Okay, well, thanks for that. Yeah.
You're welcome.
That's
here's
snappy.
A title. Here's a title that's completely true. He's got all the kinds of hair a manly man should have. Buster Hine is here. Buster.
Hey.
How you doing?
Great.
I was going to also follow that up with, he might be totally hairless from the scalp down, but he's still a man in my book. But Alex isn't here. Alex is still here. Heath can't join us because Kentucky's having the worst blizzard in 30 years. So he won't be joining us today, but that's okay. We're still going to have a grand old time, as Alex would say. Has he ever said that? I'm not sure if he actually ever
has. Sounds Southern.
It sounds like something he would say before a party began. We have so much stuff to talk about this week. We talked a little bit about the Apple Car last week, and then right as we finished recording, we got some new news from Wall Street Journal about the type of Apple Car that Cupertino might be building. So we'll be talking a little bit more about that, and according to the Wall Street Journal, Apple's working on a minivan. So
yeah, right.
If I had asked you guys last week what kind of car Apple was working on, I don't think that would have been at the top of your list. So I want to hear what you guys think about that. We also got a huge piece from The New Yorker this week all about Johnny Ive, and they were given the kind of access, Leander, I'm sure you could speak to this, that Apple never gives anyone. I mean, he was like going around with Johnny Ive and his Bentley, hanging out in the design lab, eating their, you know, like their Whole Foods nut products. You read the entire thing from front to start, I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. Yeah.
And it was, so we're going to be talking about, who is Johnny Ive? Who is he really? And how has his role evolved at Apple since his humble beginnings as an Apple product designer? And luckily for us, we have Mr. Leander Caney here, who literally wrote the book on Johnny Ive, the genius behind Apple's greatest products, available in fine bookstores near you and online and on Amazon. So Leander's going to fill in the gaps for us with all these great Johnny Ive stories. So we'll be talking about that. And we're also going to do an all-new under review at the end, App Edition. We'll be talking about some of the apps that we're reviewing and what we like and don't like about those. So stay tuned to the end for that. Leander, do you have an app picked?
Not right now. I'll have one by the end of the show.
We need to have a safe word so I can mention it so you know the segment is coming in like 2 minutes.
I'm hoping my internet's going to cut out before then and I can...
It'll just be me and Buster talking about apps that we each use. Well, before we continue, I want to say thank you to Sanebox for supporting this episode. So happy to have Sanebox back supporting us. Sanebox is the answer to everyone's too much email problem. On a daily basis, my inbox is absolutely overflowing with email. I have several different email accounts pouring into one different email account, and it's impossible to sort through manually. It just takes forever, and no one wants to waste their life doing that. Sanebox has designed a way to give you back control of your inbox, and it saves you a ton of time. All you do is activate it on your specific email account, and it works with all major email accounts. You can use it with Gmail, Hotmail, I mean, what have you, anything that you have. It does some really smart analysis in the background and will determine what emails are important to you and which ones aren't. It's incredibly accurate, and it will start filtering out the stuff that you don't want to see and show you the important stuff, and then it puts all the unimportant stuff into a digest that you can review later. And one of the things I love about it the most is when you get one of these digests, you can kind of quickly scan the emails that it thinks that you don't want to see. And when you are ready, you can just hit one button and all of them are instantly evaporated forever. You don't have to waste any time on them. And it saves hours and hours a week because, you know, who has time to set up email rules? And you're always getting new emails and it's just a waste of life. They have a ton of Fortune 500 companies using them, VCs, salespeople, realtors, managers, CEOs. If you want to check it out, head on over to sanebox.com/cultcast. That's sanebox.com/cultcast. And you can sign up for a free trial. No credit card is required. You can try out all their features for free and see how you like it. That's sanebox.com. Also want to thank Automatic for supporting this episode. Automatic is grand. You know what I was thinking about the other day, Lander, is it brings cars into the Apple car era. You know, like, what kind of car do you have, Lander?
I've got a
a Land. You have a Land Cruiser.
I was a little hesitant to admit that, but no, I'm very proud of the Land Rover. I love it. But I also have a Toyota Scion IQ.
Oh yeah, I've seen that tiny little car.
Yeah, yeah.
So if even with those newer cars, you probably know this, especially having a Land Rover, you can't really integrate anything from the car into your phone, so you don't really know any of the information that it's tracking, right?
Right.
And with the Land Rover, since you're probably getting 4 miles per gallon,
it's actually three.
It's three. Well, it's an older vehicle. It's great to have all that information at your fingertips, and same with my car. Your car is tracking all this great information, and Automatic is a little dongle that you plug into your car, works in all cars made after 1996, and instantly all that information that your car is tracking, like where you're going, how fast you're going, your gas mileage, all this plethora of information is available to you in Automatic's app on your iOS device, your iPad, your iPhone, and it is beautiful. So you can just scroll through a timeline and see all the different trips that you took. You can see maps of where you went. You could see how much gas you used on those different trips, and it actually calculates how much gas you use and how much it costs you based on, you know, real-time gas prices in your area. And not only that, but you get to find out where you're parked. So Automatic automatically tracks via the app where you parked, so you never lose your car. You can track other drivers, so younger drivers, and help them, you know, drive more safely and make sure they aren't driving down the freeway at 175 miles an hour. There's a ton of other features too. They integrate with IFFT, if this, then that. Did I say that right, Buster?
They call themselves IFT now. IFT is how they want you to say it.
Okay, yeah. That's the hip way to say it. Which opens up a whole plethora of other options for Automatic because people are building things via IFT that Automatic integrates with. So, for instance, if you want your car to log your miles to a Google Doc every time you get home, you can do that. There's all this great functionality that's constantly being developed for Automatic. And plus, on top of everything else, it helps you drive more safely because Automatic chirps at you when you brake too hard, when you accelerate too quickly, and also helps you turn off your check engine light if it comes on and will tell you like what's wrong with your car. So it saves you a lot of money. And it makes you drive more safely by being aware of your driving habits. Check it out. Go to automatic.com/cult. The Automatic link, which is what you plug in your car, sells for $100. But if you go to automatic.com/cult, you'll get one for $80. And a 45-day return policy. If you don't like it, you can return it. Free shipping. That's automatic.com/cult. I want to thank Automatic for supporting this episode. Lander, let's start with the big story this week. Mm-hmm. This massive, massive piece the New Yorker wrote on Johnny Ive. First of all, let me ask you this. They were given unparalleled access to Johnny Ive, to the design lab, to all the different industrial designers that Johnny Ive interacts with and helps create all these Apple products that we use day in, day out. Would this kind of access been granted if Steve Jobs was still alive?
I don't think so. No, definitely not. I mean, no. What am I saying? Yeah, no, absolutely not.
We're witnessing the evolution of Lander's opinion here, folks.
Right. Well, you know, like, because I'm trying to think on previous occasions, whenever Jobs invited people, you know, to Dano Apple, to reporters to hang out, it was like for a couple of days and they'd always feed them some, you know, sort of kind of somewhat, definitely pre-canned, you know, story about it. And it was always on the eve of a product. So the one I'm thinking about is like the the G4 iMac.
Mm-hmm.
And they told him about how it was inspired by a sunflower in Steve Jobs' garden down in Palo Alto. And, Lev Grossman was a writer. It was done for Time, and he hung out there for like 2 days. And his basically the story they told him was this, Walter Isaacson was probably the last, outsider who was allowed in the design lab.
Mm-hmm.
Outsiders are never allowed down there. And definitely, I don't think anyone has ever done anything so in depth about Apple. I mean, not even Isaacson, which is one thing I sort of, pointed out on the blog was that, the biggest funny about Isaacson's biography was that he never really delved into how Apple works. And this is, as detailed as anyone's done so far in an official capacity. I mean, he still, there was a lot of stuff I saw there was, he didn't really get into the nitty gritty exactly how Apple works and how the design department works. But it definitely got that part of, about its centrality to what Apple does.
And I think that's kind of to points you've made in the past, that's kind of one of the things that's been missing from Apple's story is how central the design team is
to
virtually everything they do, right? Especially these days.
Oh, yeah. It's been true since Jobs came back. I mean, since the iMac. Even kind of before then, but of course their work wasn't getting recognized. But I mean, this is what Jobs did. The biggest change he made structurally to Apple was to make the design department, the industrial design department, the very center of what Apple does and the sort of the product factory. Before then, it was coming from all these different departments, mainly engineering. But, they would set up committees, and it would be the worst kind of, mess. Jobs made sure that the design department was the very center of everything they did. And more so than that, I mean, there was a great quote in there from Robert Bruner, who was the guy who originally set it up. And he said that, design in a lot of other companies is like a stripe, and it's just one in a whole series of chain of events.
Mm-hmm.
And at Apple, it's like a big vertical stripe that goes through everything. So everything they do, the design department's involved. And that's true, of even servicing their products and in the Apple stores, the Genius Bar, when they come to fixing them, all of that is figured out by the design department, the packaging. They're involved in the advertising, the marketing, the stores, it's at the very, very heart. And for sure, that is something that is not well known. I mean, like if you look at the two big books about Apple last year, Fred Vogelstein's Dogfight and Yukari Kane's book. I mean, they hardly mentioned Johnny Ive or the Apple Studio. It all centers on Tim Cook and the CEO. And I think people think that because Tim Cook's the CEO, they're like, if Johnny Ive was so important, how come he's not the CEO? And which I think sort of
wondered that before myself. Why don't you think he would go for that position?
Well, because the CEO is, it's kind of the worst job in the company, and it goes away from what I mean. He's in the catbird seat, right? He's in the best position because he has responsibility, or they're his products or his department's products, the design studio's products, but he doesn't have to have the responsibility of making sure that that all the components are. Going to be supplied, or that that they've got the marketing people are in on the advertising campaign. He can focus on the products and development of the products without having to worry about the bigger picture, the overall running of the company.
Can I back up a sec? And I wanted to ask you guys, and Buster, feel free to chime in if you have anything to say about this, is why now? Why all of a sudden is Apple, they just hired Chris Breen from Macworld, they hired Anand Shimpi from AnandTech, and now they're doing this huge piece. They're allowing the New Yorker to come in and see Apple's secret sauce. Why? What's the benefit of all this to them? And why all of a sudden start being so open? Does anyone have any thoughts?
Well, Buster, what do you think?
I don't. I mean, I don't know. I don't really know. I think it helps the image a little bit. Boosts up like the different execs in Apple, and you saw I thought the comments on Jeff Williams were actually kind of interesting. He seems like a cool dude who drives a Corolla.
Oh yeah, the Apple vice president that drives an old, wasn't it a like, Camry, like a Toyota or something. Camry.
And I think he made the second most at Apple last year, like more than Tim Cook, which is just he seems like a humble dude. And then it gave a better picture of like Apple, and also better picture than what Walter Isaacson gave. And then also some of the secrets about the design lab, I also think like, oh, they're going to close that in like 18 months anyway. So that's not going to be a big secret anymore anyway, because it'll be gone.
Well, they're moving to the new campus, you mean?
Yeah. Right, yeah.
Okay, I was like, wait a second. Did I miss that part in the story?
Yeah, yeah.
Lander, what do you think? I mean, all access to the design lab. Well, why?
Well, Jobs took it. I think he was heavily influenced by Disney, where Disney didn't want anyone to know about how they made their movies or what happened at the parks, because he didn't want to destroy the magic. And, you know, like, so Jobs was crazy secretive. And I've talked to a lot of ex-Apple employees, and you know, a lot of them are frustrated, I think, that they've been involved in, you know, these historic products, and it's part of history. And they look at, like, you know, the story of the original Mac with Andy Hertzfeldt and Bruce Horn and Bill Atkinson, and those stories are pretty well told. You know, they're public now, and those guys get a lot of credit for what they did with the original Macintosh. But no one knows, you know, anything about, you know, the all the products that were there, you know, from the iMac almost during the Jobs era, and, you know, the iPhone and the iPad, and they these have been huge impact. I mean, they've had on society and culture. Yeah.
Like Susan Curry, like she's, you know, like a celebrated artist because she made icons for the Mac. You know, now we don't really know anybody who's done exactly all the pixel work on iOS and stuff like that.
Right, absolutely. And it's frustrating, you know, to these guys because, you know, they're completely anonymous and their work is, you know, it's super well known, but no one knows who did it. So plus, I think there's also like this, you know, that it's the part of the Tim Cook era. I think where they're being a little more open, you know, Katie Cotton has gone and she was very, very, you know, controlling. And I think that this is, you know, one of those, this is probably the first of that little more, you know, slightly more open Apple. And that, you know, telling this kind of stuff doesn't do it any harm. It's not revealing any of their plans. It doesn't, you know, help the competitors. I, like you said, I think it sort of humanizes Apple a little more as well, because it's like, you know, it's starting to tell you a little bit about the people who are involved in making these products.
I found it incredibly humanizing. I mean, I didn't know anything about Johnny Ive, really. You know, things that you've heard, things that we've talked about on this show. But the picture I got of this man as a human was really what I took away from the piece. And one of the things that I wanted to mention that they mentioned right at the very top of this piece is, you know, Johnny Ive would describe himself as deeply, deeply tired. And for whatever reason, that resonated with me, and I actually felt very sad for him. He is this guy who Apple's depending on to create all the products that allow them to exist, and he has a team of people that help him, but he feels the burden of that responsibility, and he also described himself as always anxious, and he's uncomfortable knowing that 100,000 Apple employees rely on his decision-making every day. You know, I think, like, I was surprised how emotional and emotive he was, and what a kind man he seemed to be, and everyone who works for him really loves him. Like, it made me have a whole different perspective on Apple, because when you think of Apple, historically for me, you think of Steve Jobs, Conker, you know, megamaniacal, monomaniacal. I mean, that's the kind of thing that you think about, and now I have a much more soft regard for Apple as a company. Did you guys take any of those Johnny Ive feelings away?
Yeah, I thought it, you know, mixed in like good and bad too. I thought, you know, definitely made him seem like he's a guy who wants to be liked, and so he has to balance that. And but also, there's like, you know, he drives to work in like a, what was it, like a Bentley, like with a yeah, his own driver, you know?
And well, he's like, hey, for the record, he was uncomfortable getting a driver, right? He didn't want to, but he did it.
Yeah, I'm sure if Steve Jobs didn't want a driver, he would have said, no, I'm sorry, I'm going to drive and I'm going to park in the handicap spot still.
You know what I was just thinking, and Alander, I'd be curious to hear what you think about this, is maybe they did this, maybe they allowed this access because before it was so focused around Steve Jobs. Right. And everyone was worried that Steve Jobs was going to leave, and it affected the stock price, obviously, a lot, you know, based upon things that were going on with him. And maybe this is their attempt to say, hey, look, Steve Jobs was a part of this company, but we have this whole team of people working here, and there's no one piece of the machine that's based upon one person. Do you think that maybe that might be it?
Yeah, although that piece kind of anointed, Johnny Ive as that.
Actually, yeah, that's the problem with it. They would need like 12 more pieces like this about Angela, about Jeff Williams, and Air Force One.
He's if he goes, I'm done with this podcast.
Johnny was on record in Isaacson's book of saying exactly that. You know that he thought that the public ascribing the company's success purely to Steve Jobs made them vulnerable. And you know, did have an adverse effect on things like the stock price, but also the perception of the company as well. So yeah, that's definitely a good point.
Well, he also mentioned in there that he wanted to leave before Steve, or it was thinking about it in 2009 before Steve Jobs got really sick. And then, I mean, I think like a piece like this, it puts him so much higher that now, if Johnny Ive leaves, dang, then Apple's really in trouble. Right. You know, it kind of puts him in the same spot as the Steve Jobs thing.
Right. Well, that's what his old colleague, Clive Grenier, told me. And that's the last chapter of my book, which is that, in Grenier's opinion and in some other, in some people's opinion, that he has become more critical to Apple than Jobs was. But when at the end of Jobs' career.
Mm-hmm. So let's actually talk about that, Leander. I want to talk about how critical Johnny Ive has become to the company. But could you start with how he even began at Apple and what he was doing right when he started?
Sure. Yeah, he was a partner in a company in London. Mm-hmm. Three or four designers. Clive Grenier was one of them, and they were a consultancy. So they were doing work for everybody. They were doing power tools and they were doing toilets and sinks. And then Robert Bruner, who had moved to Apple by that time, was interested in recruiting him. So he did some contract work with this company, Tangerine. And they were given. In fact, the funny thing is, they were, it was tablets. They were designing. Tablets and laptops around the Newton platform, which hadn't actually come out then, but it was actually still in it was just about to. So they'd already developed the first Newton handheld, but they were looking at like making it into a whole range of products. Mm-hmm. So they, Bruner gave them Tangerine this project, and it was a way of sort of like getting trying to recruit Johnny to the company, and he joined in '92, I think. And he was actually kind of reluctant to. I mean, him and his wife, they flew him out three times. And I didn't really want to, even though he loved California and loved the optimism, and he was getting sick of working for clients in the UK. He wanted to join an organization because as a contract designer, they would be told to develop these products. They'd have a lot of freedom and a lot of power, but then, they'd hand them over to the client, and then the client would often mess them up.
Botch them all up with a bad taste.
Exactly. So it was hugely frustrating, and he wanted to get inside an organization and have more of an impact. And so he had these ambitions, but, when he joined, Apple was just about to get into real trouble. And for the first couple of years, they were like in this sort of tailspin. And we're about to go out of business.
And that was when Gil Amelio was still running it, right?
Right, exactly. Okay. And at that point, the design studio was like it was off campus. It was in it's across the way on Valley Green Road, and that initially was kind of a good idea because Bruner, when he set it up, he wanted the design organization, and this is true even today, to run like an agency. Like he came from a design agency, and he wanted it to be like. They'd have that independence and they were able to like to work things out without having to compromise to engineers and other executives. So they wanted some independence from the organization, and that was like a double-edged sword. They could develop all this stuff to their own specifications, but then getting it implemented became a bit of a problem. And then and this is the battle that Bruner was trying to fight and kind of lost. And so that's when he left and he said, I recommend that Johnny take over the department here when I leave.
He's like, here, you do it.
Right.
<I'm> done. Yeah.
And then Emilio never really, Emilio didn't implement that vision, they were still there. They were banging out making all these models and prototypes, but they were having a hard time getting them, onto the product roadmap. Mm-hmm. Until Jobs came back, and Jobs was like, whoa, look at this stuff. This is exactly what we need. I mean, Jobs was always interested in design and always felt that design, was one of the three main tentpoles of the company. And when he saw the work that Johnny Ive and the design studio was doing, what he did was empower it. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, whatever the design studio's decisions carried a lot more weight than they had done before. And over the 12 years that, you know, that before Jobs passed, you know, that essentially was the major restructuring of the company, was to put the design studio at the very heart of everything that they did. And they took over eventually more and more.
And now we're here today, and I mean, in this New Yorker piece, they essentially said Johnny Ive, you know, is Apple, and the design team is involved in pretty much everything. Is that not right? I mean, even not just the products, but the marketing material, the videos that you see, the experiences that you have at the Apple store.
Right.
They have their hands in everything. Is that right?
Yeah. And that had been true for quite a while as well. You know, I mean, like before Jobs died, he was, you know, Tim Cook had sort of taken over. He was like the COO, and he'd already taken over kind of a lot of the CEO duties. So he was basically doing Jobs' you know, he was basically the sort of, you know, the CEO in waiting. And Jobs was like, you know, Johnny had been attending all of Jobs' meetings for years already. Mm-hmm. And I was already like meeting with the software people. He was already meeting with the marketing people. He was already giving his opinion, you know, on like the latest ads, on the stores, on the store layouts, you know, everything that, you know, Jobs was doing as CEO, Johnny was already involved in and had been for years.
So now they're touching absolutely everything, which may be why Johnny Ive describes himself as deeply, right. deeply tired.
Yeah, exactly.
I kind of feel like he's in a gilded cage.
Yeah.
I really genuinely felt bad for him.
Yeah, maybe.
Because do you think that he loves doing what he does, Leander, or do you feel like he does it because that's his routine and he knows there's a lot of people who rely on him to run Apple and or to create all these different products? Do you feel like he still loves what he does?
Yeah, you know, I definitely. He does, and he has like, you know, I think that, you know, heavy is the head that wears the crown, right? So, there is a huge responsibility on him, and you know, with these rumors of the Apple Car and you know, Tim Cook talking about other products that they haven't gotten into, the Apple Watch, I think is going to be a major platform. You know, the first three models we're going to see in a month or so are just the beginning of, like, you know, I think a major line of wearables, you know, that could go in a lot of different directions, including clothing, you know, and fashion. Who else has been, one of the interesting things they compare, you know, one of the memes about Johnny Ive is that he's been ripping off Dieter Rams and Braun for years, right? Mm-hmm. And it was like, oh, look, you know, they do comparisons between these Braun products and Apple products. And they'd say, you know, spot the difference in how the original iPod looks like an old Braun transistor radio, or the Mac Pro looks like some kind of Braun stereo component. But, you know, they pointed out that Johnny Ive and Apple are making these products on a scale of magnitude so much greater than Braun ever achieved. And that's like, you know, I don't think there's ever been a company in the history of industry that has had, you know, that is turning out products on such a massive scale, mm-hmm. and has had such a huge, huge influence. I mean, this is bigger than Ford or General Motors or any of the big motor companies. I mean, I can't think of any other company in the history of industry that is like making, you know, products at this scale.
Maybe Samsung, maybe.
Oh, well, okay.
Except, right. Apple, Samsung, yeah. Except Apple actually sells theirs.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's true. Samsung's a good example. Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah, right, exactly. But, you know,
But Samsung has thousands of products. Apple has products that fit onto a couple of tables.
Yeah, and so, look at
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, if you look at the amount of money that Apple is making, you know, over and above Samsung, it's like it's more. But yeah, totally. No, that's a good example. But, you know, these companies, Apple and Samsung, you know, I mean, I don't think nothing is really. For somebody who's interested in designing and in making, I mean, it's really in such a historical position. You know, I think it would be hard to step away from that. It's like Napoleon, you know, stepping down from his role as emperor. There's such an enormous power and influence that's at stake.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But he doesn't seem to revel in it. He seems like he performs the task that he is given, but he doesn't take any great pride. And maybe I'm wrong, but he doesn't seem to take any great pride in being Johnny Ive. Like he's very shy. He doesn't want to be on stage. He doesn't want, you know, to have people, you know, heaping praise on top of him. He just kind of wants to do his job, and he's passionate about design, so that's what he does.
Yeah, right. Well, there was a really great and very fitting description there, which is like a man who's sort of bowing and backing his way into the throne.
Yeah, right. He's no Robert Baratheon. He didn't go take the throne.
Right.
If you follow me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was there anything else that you guys took away from this piece that you want to mention, Buster or Leander?
Well, you know, I hate to say it, but I saw my fingerprints on it, and I was really hoping for a shout out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the same, you know, things were mentioned, a lot of the same interviewees and a lot of the same details, the same basic storyline.
Really? So you feel like maybe they used your book as a blueprint of who to contact and how to kind of aggregate the story?
Well, you know, and I'm yeah, basically. I'm pretty sure he read it.
For lack of a better way to say it, yes.
Pretty sure he read it. Yeah, for sure. Uh-huh. You know, that's a bit frustrating. But,
yeah, and of course it's
frustrating to see that, you know, like, I mean, all the 18 months of work that I put in where I didn't get any, that nothing was official. I wasn't invited to write in the limousine.
Uh-huh.
Or to visit the design studio. And, you know, it was really gratifying to see that a lot of the stuff that I got from, you know, my sources where I had to like dig and hunt for it was validated, you know, like, mm-hmm. so, you know, there's a description of the design studio. It's actually more detailed than the one in the New Yorker. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's the same. I mean, there were some people complaining on Twitter. Oh, this is, I already knew all this stuff, you know, from reading.
You're just like rolling your eyes. You're like, yeah, I already know all this information.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, I don't want it like to be in the second paragraph, like a, you know, like a huge shout out, but it would have been nice.
You should have been some dedication at the front of the of the book, so to speak.
Yeah, you know, it was good to see it all validated, and it's good to see, and it you know, overall it helps, right? I think, you know, to see, because it does validate the book, and it also validates the whole argument that, you know, that this is the guy who's the most important person at Apple now, which had been the whole thesis of my book. So that was super gratifying to see that.
It's interesting to me that people don't know that. That they honestly believe that Steve Jobs is the one who like thought up the iPhone, he's the one that thought up the iPad, and that he's responsible for creating all these different products. And what you're saying is that's really not the case at all. He just kind of showed up for the company picture.
No, that's not true either. And, you know, I just did a bunch of interviews with another Apple guy who was very central to what, you know, they did, and I'm still trying to, you know, try to finish this up, but. You know, he was explaining that, you know, Jobs' role was super complex. I mean, these are all Jobs' products. Mm-hmm. These are all Steve's products, and they all have Steve's fingerprints on them. He influenced how they, you know, that not only the idea of them, but also how they turned out. And even so, even now, right, you know, they're still working on Steve's. This is all Steve's vision. Of course, he saved the company, and he put together the teams, and, you know, he led the vision for the whole thing, right? Mm-hmm. So, of course, super, super important. But also, he didn't design any of the stuff, really. I mean, like, he evaluated other people's work.
Yeah.
And so his, you know, this leadership role is really slippery and hard to pin down.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, all the good, you know, like all the people who were responsible for these products are still there, and they're still working together the same way, more or less the same way they worked together before.
Well, so, to your point,
the magic continues.
I was thinking it was interesting that in the piece it said that they have three different recruiters looking for design people to join the Apple design team, and they might find one person a year. Three different recruiters, right?
Yeah.
The team is very tight-knit, and Leander, you've said this before on this show. Like, they go on vacations together, they work together, they hang out together. And then also, only two designers have left in the last 15 years, and one of them was due to illness. So for the most part, as you just said, all those people that have been working on those projects for all this time actually all still work together. Can you imagine working with the same design team for 15 years? They must be able to finish each other's sentences.
Right. And I think they do.
Like, there's no way you could fart in that lab without someone knowing who it was. There's just no way.
Well, they don't even talk anymore. They just look at each other and they nod, and then someone rolls an eye.
Right.
Yeah.
One last note about this piece, and if you haven't read it, we'll link to it in the show notes. It's really super long, but so well written. Very, very interesting read. It may take you a half hour to an hour to get actually.
But 17,000 words, which is like a, you know, my book was like 85, I think.
Really? Jeez.
So, you know, it's you know, like a quarter of it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very, very long. Your cursor, your little scrolling cursor on the right side of your Mac, it's going to be like a little tiny dot as you scroll through this thing.
I started reading at about 7 a.m. and then I had to, like, you know, before I came to work, and I'm like, I'll go to work as soon as I finish. I didn't get to work till about 10:30.
Yeah, it took me forever to get through it all too, and I had to do it in chunks because it was just it's just so freaking long.
But I saw a lot of people saying TLDR right on Twitter. So if people are interested, they can always pick up the audio of my, you know, the Audible version of my book.
Yeah, that's right. Hey, that's a great plug. And actually, before we move on and start talking about Alp Cars, you know, you could read Leander's book. Everyone who's read it has said it's the best book they've ever read. Which is funny because I say that jokingly, but it's actually true.
I think I said the best book about Apple they've
ever read. The best book about Apple that they've ever read. Yeah,
that's what Horace Diddy said about it.
Exactly. Nice. Yeah. But some people have also said, I'm sure. I haven't heard them say it, Leander, but it's just the best book they've ever read, period. It's like the Bible. Remember your book. So you can get it on Amazon. You can get it anywhere books are sold. And they also have it on Audible, which if you go to Audible, just go to audiblepodcast.com/cultcast, and you can actually get the book for free, which is far less than its cost would be otherwise. So before we move on, because I do want to talk about the Apple car, aka the Apple minivan, and I want to hear your thoughts on it, but I do want to thank Varidesk for supporting this episode, and not just for supporting this episode, but for helping me have rock hard glutes. Can you guys hear that?
Oh,
guess
yeah.
What I'm knocking on. That's the sound of your glutes talking. That's because Varidesk makes a portable standing desk that you can put on any desk that you use. It goes from a seated position to a standing position in 3 seconds or less. They have models for single monitors. They have models for double monitors. They are truly the least expensive, highest quality way that I know to get into a standing desk. And here's why you guys need to all be standing throughout your workday. People don't realize how bad it is to sit. And I'm going to give you a little example, and I think you're going to be surprised. So when you sit, your metabolism slows down to almost nothing. Comparatively, when you're standing, especially if you're moving around, you burn an extra, depending on how heavy you are. I'm about 170, so between 30 and 50 calories per hour extra that you stand. So I stand, I'd say, about 4 hours a day. So that's about 200 calories a day. Do you know how many calories you burn on a 30-minute run on average, Leander? Just take a guess.
600.
Buster, any guesses?
Like 450.
You burn probably, if you're about my weight, you would burn probably about 275.
No.
So when you stand for about 4 hours a day, and if you do a little movement throughout the day, you're going to burn almost as much as if you went running for every day that you do that. Multiply that times a week, you've burned 1,400 calories. Guess how many calories are in a pound? 1,600. It is a fantastic way to lose weight, to stay trim. It keeps your metabolism high, and it's like doing exercise throughout your day without you actually having to do anything is the ultimate exercise hack, because you're going to be burning calories by doing absolutely nothing more than you would normally do. That's why I love having a standing desk, and I think that once you get used to it, you're going to love it too. And that's why you need one that goes from a seated to a standing position very easily, because you're going to get tired as you stand. You need to go down and up easily. Varidesk makes that easy. Check them out, varidesk.com. They have models that start at just $275. They ship fully assembled to you straight to your door. I think you're really going to feel a lot better if you get up off your arse. And then you can be like me, where when you knock on your glutes, that's the sound that you hear. And guess what? Everyone wants rock hard glutes. Even people that say that they don't, they do. Sooner or later, you'll be bending rebar with your glutes just like me. I want to thank Varidesk for supporting this episode. Okay, guys, let's move on to, we're running a little low on time, but let's talk about the Apple Car, and then we'll wrap up with under review App Edition. So we talked about Apple Car the last two episodes, and last episode, right after we finished, as I mentioned, Wall Street Journal came out and said that Apple is indeed working on an Apple Car, and what could only have been Tim Cook's idea, it's going to be a minivan. Leander, how do you feel about driving an Apple-branded electric minivan?
Well, you know, if it's anything like my old Nissan Quest, our old Nissan Quest, which is the minivan that we have.
Oh, you had one. Oh, okay.
Yeah. That'd
be, did you
guys
get rid of that?
We did. We just donated it. Oh. It finally died. That thing was a blast to drive. It was really fast. It would really take off.
Just imagine if it had an electric motor. You could do like 0 to 60 in 3 seconds in that thing. All your kids would be like screaming in the back. It'd be great.
Yep. Great, great sound system. Had a DVD. I love that vehicle. I thought it was awesome.
Okay, but seriously, a minivan, an Apple minivan. If I had asked you guys that last week, you would have laughed in my face.
Right. Well, it's preposterous.
I doubt they're doing a minivan. If they are, it's got to be, you know, prototype stages. I mean, it's not going to come out in like the next year or anything like that. So I just doubt that they're making a minivan for real.
So you think that maybe the minivan is some type of prototype, but it's going to evolve into something different?
Maybe, yeah, possibly. Okay. I mean, all of Apple's products do, all of the prototypes, you know, that you see of like the iPad and the iPhone, they were, you know, very different from the end product.
Well, according to the Wall Street Journal, the project is called Project Titan. They have about, a few hundred people working on it, but they have charged Vice President Steve Zadesky to lead the group that's building the car, and he has been given permission to create a 1,000-person team and poach employees from different parts of the company.
Well, you know what that sounds like?
What?
That's exactly like the iPhone project.
Yeah.
The iPhone project got off the ground,
mm-hmm.
You know, where Scott Forstall was given permission to poach anybody from inside the company, and, mm-hmm. and they put together a team. I guess it was several hundred people, and the guy that's headed up is, you know, he's in what they call product development, which is actually engineering. It's like figuring out how to make the products. So they work close hand in hand with the industrial design department, and they're the sort of people they're the people who work most closely with the industrial design department to figure out how the prototypes are actually made,
mm-hmm.
how to manufacture these things, you know, what components they're going to use and how they're put together. So if this is true, then the project is getting, they're exploring, you know, how to make it.
Mm-hmm.
It's gone beyond the industrial design, the prototype stage. It's mm-hmm. gone beyond, you know, like the point where they're trying to figure out what the product is. Now they're trying to figure out how to make it.
So you're saying essentially they've decided they're going to make it. Now they're just trying to figure out how.
Right. And it'll be 2 or 3 years, you know, if it's anything like an iPhone or an iPad. But yeah, so that's a huge deal. I mean, because all of the development work, you know, there hasn't been any rumors, any leaks, nothing.
Exactly. We haven't heard a peep until all of a sudden. I mean, in the last 2 weeks, all of a sudden, oh my gosh, Apple's probably working on a car.
Yeah, right. But the rumors are all over the place. Like, you know, those minivans. Those are mapping cars. Those are mapping vehicles.
Yeah.
They're not self-driving cars.
I don't know, Leander.
No,
well, I mean, it's just
downward-facing cameras.
We've seen them everywhere. That's the thing, is it makes more sense for them to be testing a map or be doing a mapping vehicle in Brooklyn and San Francisco and Hawaii and Phoenix. They wouldn't be testing like their self-driving car like all over those places, I don't think.
Right, especially because some of those states don't even have you know, statutes, right, for self-driving cars.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Right.
So yeah, exactly, and you know, and they would be. They don't have a license here in the states that they do. So the DMV, they haven't been licensed in California to test self-driving cars. And there's actually mm-hmm. a public database you could look at to see that. So, they might be doing mapping for self-driving cars because that same data could be used to, you know, for a self-driving vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
But they're probably mapping those ones. But anyway, yeah, that's probably where the minivan thing comes from. I mean, they're all over the place, though. And then, you know, like they can do an EV or it's going to be self-driving or, you know, it's like very unclear exactly what they are going to do.
Is there any doubt in your mind? Well, this is a two-part question, Professor Caney. Is there any doubt in your mind that Apple's building a car?
Well, yeah.
That we will see on the market?
Yeah, there's doubt. Okay. But it's also really intriguing.
Yeah.
And it's really intriguing. And I think, you know, like it is the kind of thing that Apple would do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but it's the world's biggest, product segment by revenue.
And it seems ripe for disruption, doesn't it?
Oh, man. Yeah, right. Yeah. And I think like Buster pointed out, you know, in a quote in a story that he published last week was, you know, people said the same thing about Apple getting into the cell phone business. Oh, they don't make cell phones. They're a computer maker. You know,
well, yeah, they, but they'll be. They that. Said, "Oh, I mean, because there's all kinds of stuff with testing them, even with cell phones. You know, Apple had to build like those huge buildings for the signal stuff and everything. So they're going to have to, you know, invest in testing grounds for the car. I don't know. I think it's a crazy ambitious project, but it'll be awesome if they pull it off.
Well, yeah, but Tesla pulled it off because, I mean, Tesla was really, right. I mean, Tesla's basically a design and marketing firm, just like sort of, you know, like Apple. They outsourced the manufacturing. And what they had was like, you know, they didn't have a dealer network. I mean, they set up like stores, actually with an ex-Apple executives, you know, their own stores. So, you know, they could really shake up the whole auto industry, although there are definitely a whole bunch of challenges too.
Isn't Johnny Ive working with Angela Arendt on redesigning Apple store retail space?
Yeah, they're going to get Apple Watch. They're going to be put out. They're going to have them up at the mall with a whole bunch of balloons and those like those those creatures that like go up and down.
Oh yeah, the wind saw creatures. Yeah, right. And all the hoods are going to be up with a sign that says SALE.
Under new management,
right? Yeah, and then, exactly. And then all the geniuses are going to be like these really tough big guys who like really pressure you into getting some extra insurance.
And the Apple car you're looking at. It's going to be low mileage. He's going to be, look, I swear, it was driven by a grandma. She barely used it. And you look great in this car. You want to go for a drive?
Right, totally. That's exactly that's what she's doing. That's what she's known for.
So, second part of the question. If Apple does end up releasing a car, is there any doubt in your mind it will be electric?
See, I feel like if they're making a car, I feel like Apple has like bigger ambitions than just shaking up the industry. They'd want to do something that's like also beneficial to humanity in some ways too. That seems like their MO.
That's a good point, yeah.
And so I feel like, yeah, it would definitely be electric because, you know, just a gas car is not going to be, you know, something that really moves humanity forward in any way.
Kind of off topic. Have you guys heard about this home battery that Tesla is trying to develop?
Yeah, it sounds awesome.
Buster, do you know enough to tell us about it?
Yeah, I mean, one of the big problems, like here in Arizona, we've talked about it before, that, you know, so the solar industry would be great because we have more sun than anybody. But because of like the grid, the utility companies have made it more problematic and not worth it because, you know, there's like, you know, you're still sharing the grid. So Tesla's proposal to shake all of that up is to build a giant battery for your house so that, you know, when you have extra energy, you just store it in that instead of sending it back off to the grid to your utility company, and you save it for yourself to be used, you know, whenever you need it.
It's kind of genius, isn't it? Let me paint you a picture brilliant. Of that titillated me. So you have Tesla that has their primary technology, and one of the things they're working on is the battery technology, right? I mean, that's what they really need to master in order for their cars to go long range and be inexpensive enough for normal consumers. So now they take that battery technology, they build it into your house, and Elon Musk also is part of the board of SolarCity, who makes solar panels. And from what I've heard, they're very inexpensive. In fact, they'll lease you solar panels for less than you pay for electricity and gas each month to, you know, power your home. So you have these solar panels on top of your house. They charge a huge battery that you have in your house, which powers your house. Not only that, but you can use the battery or the solar panels to charge your Apple car that sits out in your driveway. And now you're totally power independent. You could put your house literally anywhere, right? Because if you don't need electricity, you know, connected to the grid, then you could literally be off in the forest. Buster, this is going to be perfect for you.
I know, right? You just put an RV with a bunch of solar panels and get going. Well,
you've always wanted to be a hermit. Now you can have cable and satellite TV and all that great stuff as you're being a hermit in the middle of nowhere.
I mean, it is awesome. Yeah.
Well, people are already talking about, well, you know, you could use your car as one of these storage units.
You can. You can use
it's already got a bank of batteries. Yeah. So if you hook it up into your system at home, you could, you know, possibly use that as a backup or even as a storage system if you're not out driving it, of course. But yeah, you know, like one of the things that hasn't really been talked about much is like I think car ownership is changing a lot. Yeah. And, a lot of young people, especially in cities like San Francisco, you know, just aren't getting cars anymore. Mm-hmm. I think car ownership is down, right? Quite significantly.
Right. Yeah. And I don't want to buy a new car, that's for sure.
Right. I mean, but, you know, I find it, people are talking about ride sharing and Uber and, you know, if Apple's going to get into electric car, maybe they would take those things into account that, you know, the ownership model of it, like where everyone has to have their own vehicle, you know, maybe they're looking at some other stuff, but it's kind of hard to imagine, right? Yeah.
Why?
Well,
why do you think that's difficult?
Just because, I mean, look at, like Apple is the sort of quintessential personal device manufacturer, right? With, ever more so with the iPod and the iPhone and the Apple Watch. I mean, you can't imagine sharing your Apple Watch with anybody else.
Right. You're not going to buy a $50,000 Apple car and lease it out with friends.
Yeah, right. Or the neighborhood, or even they're going to build fleets of these things for companies like Uber. It's hard to imagine them really changing that model. But I don't know. There's definitely things, these kind of things are afoot, right? And, in a lot of cities, it doesn't make any sense to have a car. You just join a scheme like Zipcar or if you want to get a car for away for the weekend, and there's the Uber everywhere.
Yeah, if you live in a big city especially. Alrighty, well, I just wanted to paint that vision for you guys because it gets me excited, and it does seem like Apple is almost certainly going to release a car. They're certainly working on one, it seems like, but whether or not they'll actually release it is kind of the question, because they're always working on new stuff and investigating new technologies, and they have multiple prototypes for all these different things that they're working on, so maybe we won't ever see a car. It could end up being like some of the other things we talked about on this show, like sapphire crystal glass iPhone displays. Right, we talked about for 12 months straight and then completely evaporated. Let's move on to the last segment of the show. Let's talk about the apps that we are currently using. And this is great. We're doing an all new under review, and we can talk about things that we like and things that we don't like. So you can feel free to hate on some apps if you want, Buster. Does anyone want to go first?
Yeah, I'll go first.
Okay, Buster, what you got?
Yeah, I actually got a cool new app for photography people. It's called Darkroom.
I've heard of this.
Yeah, it's basically kind of like Lightroom on your iPhone, and it gives you, a quick editor. What's nice about it is you don't have to import all of your photos. Like, all of them are right there, and you can quickly edit them. You can do a lot of, it's non-destructive editing, so you can just go back if, you did something that's wrong. But, like, the best feature is, like, the curves. Like you would use in Lightroom, so that you can, create your own filters to like adjust the tone exactly the way you want. Mm-hmm. And so you can do like the RGB channel, or you can do it individually by the red, green, or blue hues. And then you can apply that filter to like any picture and that you want in your camera roll too. So it's very powerful, but also pretty super simple to use at the same time.
Is this a new app?
It just came out, I think, this week or maybe last week.
I thought it's been out for months. Okay.
Yeah.
How much does it cost?
It's free, but to use the curve feature, you got to pay $199.
Okay. So or $299. And then you pay more to use the features that you may or may not want to use. Okay.
Yeah.
Leander, have you come up with something yet, or do you need a few more moments?
Does it have to be just an app, or can it be an app with a, with a hardware component?
If it has hardware that includes an app, sure.
So I've been testing these Avia Bluetooth LED bulbs from Elgato. Mm-hmm. And it was funny because they sent it in to us, and it was sitting around the office for months. Like, no one was really interested to touch this thing. Because I thought of all the, if you look at home automation and smart homes and like, light bulbs that change color, really was like, way down on my list of things that I wanted to do.
Yeah, really? Because those actually excite me.
Well, do they do? Well, they excite a lot of people because, after I looked into it, like the Philips Hue system, is like, I think, one of the best-selling accessories at the Apple Store.
Wow.
And after I installed it, I was like, oh, my God, this thing is great. It's absolutely fantastic, because the lights we have, like, in the living room, it's when you turn it on, it's like being inside a photocopier, right? It's like a huge blast of white light I can't, I don't really like it because it's too bright. But then as soon as you put this thing in and you can change, all these different moods, you can put on this flickering effect. So it's like being at a big cozy fire in your living room, and it's sort of flickering above, or you can have a Northern Lights effect. So it's like the aura borealis.
So it's kind of like pulsing and stuff?
Yeah. Well,
that's actually really cool.
It's very subtle. It's very subtle. So they're actually really nice. Uh-huh. And I was like, oh my God. So I went and I bought 10 of them. And so I'm going to put them, they haven't arrived yet, but I'm going to put them all around the house. This is like, oh my, this totally changes the whole place, right? Because, it's really great for, it's super easy to turn the lights down, turn them up, change the lighting for the living room. Uh-huh. I really got a kick out of it. And I really like the hard thing to pin down is what an effect it has on you know, your mood and
oh, totally. Yeah, majorly.
Yeah. I didn't really realize that until I'd had them for a little while, you know. Uh-huh. Like, I found it a lot more calming and a lot more, I felt more comfortable in the house, you know. Huh. Strange things are a little difficult to put, you know, you have to sort of think about it in retrospect to realize that you had those feelings.
Like, you didn't realize. I mean? Yeah, absolutely. So you didn't even realize there was a problem until you switched and you're like, wow, I feel much better now.
Right.
It kind of like sets the lighting stage in your home and you feel more relaxed or calm or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. And so actually, you know, it seems trivial, but it's actually had the biggest effect. It's really, really is a big effect. I'm really surprised by that.
You know, it's like going to a concert and they change the lights throughout the concert and it evokes different feelings, you know, as you see them. I think that lighting is really powerful. In a way, it's a lot like music. They can change it and it can totally change your mood. I started using a daylight bulb in my office and it's made a huge difference because now I feel like there's just a lot of bright light coming in. It's behind me, so I don't ever really get to see it, but it's definitely elevated my mood. And I like
that's
having
funny.
What?
Yeah. Well, because, you know, coming from England, I know exactly what you're talking about. I mean, you know, because it rains so much and it's always overcast and gloomy. And,
right. Exactly.
And there was a lot of talk in the UK about SAD, you know, seasonal affective disorder.
Yeah.
And how people get the blues. And that's funny, you know, like when I was leaving, they were just starting to do that kind of thing, like, mm-hmm. like change the lighting. But yeah, huh? I can totally relate to
and
that.
And were you like, oh, bollocks.
Well, you know, Mike, you know, go down the pub and sink about 12 pints of beer.
That's exactly. That might be why, because you're like, you haven't seen the sun in 9 months.
Yeah. Well, that's why there's so much heavy drinking in all the Scandinavian countries. I mean, it's either that or you kill yourself.
Drinking is way more fun.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'll take the last app, obviously, since you guys have gone already. So I have been reviewing an app. It's a Mac app. It's an iOS app called Tidal, T-I-D-A-L. It is a high quality music streaming service and I love it and I hate it.
Didn't Jay-Z just buy this?
Jay-Z app? Just purchased it. Yeah. So he bought the company and I hope he makes improvements. So from an audio perspective, it's absolutely the most amazing audio that I've ever streamed. It's incredible. It's CD quality sound. It sounds unbelievable. And I have it running through this Marantz HD DAC-1 amplifier that I'm reviewing. It's a headphone amplifier, so it amplifies that really high quality audio. And I'm using a pair of Hi-Fi-Man HE500 magnetic, planar magnetic headphones. So you have to have the right equipment to really get the best quality out of a service like Tidal, but it certainly makes an effect, has an effect, even if you have just regular, you know, over the ear headphones or something. You, at least for me, I notice a difference. Audio quality, A+, outstanding. The problem is their Mac app is one of the biggest pieces of crap I have ever used in my life. It's terrible. I mean, truly, truly terrible. They should be embarrassed. It's that bad. It's so bad that it actually makes me want to cancel the service and just go back to Spotify, because you realize just how great Spotify is and Audio is when you use an app that's not built very well. I don't know what technology they're using, but it's not a native Mac app. It never wants to load. When you save things to your playlist, they don't actually get saved. It looks like it was built in, like, do you guys remember Adobe Air, which was that Adobe product that they used to build applications that worked on, you know, Mac and PC? It's probably like Java or something like that, where it's like a multi-platform app, but it doesn't feel native on any of the platforms you actually use it on. It's truly bad. And their iOS app, though, is actually not that bad at all. It's not as good as Spotify, but it's way more polished than their Mac app. So I'm kind of on the fence on whether or not I'm going to stay a subscribing member to Tidal, because, as I said, the audio is unbelievable. But the app is just so bad, I kind of am like, oh, man, can't Spotify just activate this? Can they not just flip a switch and say, oh, you guys want to pay $20 a month, which is, by the way, how much Tidal is? It's $20
bucks
a month. Yes.
Must really love that high def audio.
I'm a dabbler, man. A dabbler.
Goodness.
Dabbling ain't easy, dude. But couldn't Spotify just say, hey, you want to pay $20 a month? Like, we'll turn on a high quality audio for you for $20 a month. It just seems like they could flip that switch and all of a sudden Tidal would be out of business. So if you are into high quality audio, give Tidal a try. You might really like what you hear. but just be prepared to not have the best user experience because, boy, is it terrible. Buster, are you still using Spotify?
No, I use RDO.
Oh, I'm sorry. You've always been a RDO user. Yeah, I just wanted to check in with you because you've been using that forever.
Still
even though
on
everyone
it,
else has moved to Spotify, you're still holding out.
Dude, I'm going to stay with it till they close, I guess.
Have they made any significant updates to it since you've been using it in the last 2 years?
You know, I don't really know. Not really. I mean, they always change around like the design and make a little few little tweaks here and there. Kind of like Spotify, but Spotify hasn't changed a lot either.
Really? I feel like Spotify has changed a lot. They added radio.
Has it?
Oh, yeah. I think Spotify radio is as good as Pandora now. It used to be terrible.
Well,
but
Pandora
now it's pretty good.
Sucks, I think. So
Pandora does?
Yeah.
It's just like one of the features of Spotify now for me.
Yeah.
So I'm like, why would you use that? Especially on when on your desktop, you could actually listen to any Spotify music that you want. You don't have to play it on random.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? All right, let's go ahead and wrap it up there, guys. I want to say thank you to Varidesk for supporting this episode. If you're ready to get up off your buns and start standing for part of your day, check out varidesk.com, V-A-R-I-desk.com. That's all the cool casts we have for you guys this week. If you want to come say hi to us on Twitter, we would love to hear from you, especially Leander. He's L. Caney. Buster's BST3R. I'm at Airfon. And of course, for all the best news, reviews, and how-tos of the world of Apple, make sure you're following Cult of Mac. This has been the Cultcast, the best 30-plus minute Apple conversation you're going to hear all week long. New episodes of the Cultcast come out every Thursday night. I want to thank everyone for listening. Leander, why don't you send us out with a very British next time?
Till next time, toodaloo.
Does anyone say toodaloo there? I feel like that would get you punched.
Yeah. For being too British, okay?
Toodles.
Yeah, right.
Did I just call it? All right, cool. Whoopsie. I hit the wrong stop button.
Yeah.
Were you guys just sitting there twiddling your thumbs?
Well, yeah.
Alex just told me he was going to come.
Hey.
Hey, what happened?
Sorry, the blizzard has taken like all the internet out in my neighborhood.
Oh, Buster called it.
We just started getting it back today, and I think I finally got it working.
So you're having blizzard conditions in Kentucky?
Oh, yeah, it's like 2 feet of snow.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you guys normally get snow out there?
No, it's the worst it's been in like 30 years. It's going to get to negative 20 tonight.
Oh, my gosh. That's terrible.
It's miserable.
Are you calling us on your computer, Alex, or on your phone?
I'm on my computer.
Okay. And is the router still in your room as it was last time?
Yeah, it's the best it's going to get. So okay. If it's bad, let me know.
Yeah.
Did he just drop? It's pretty bad.
Alex, you still there? Y'all just go on without me. Okay. Let's be honest. That's the way we prefer it. I'm reminded of that every week when Alex comes on. I'm like, ah, yes.
How I can still I hear you, bastard. Oh.
I thought I hung up on him. Whoops.